This is the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks so much for listening. Please subscribe to this podcast by going to reason.com/podcasts. Apple, Google, Stitcher, Spotify, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, subscribe. Don't miss an episode. Today, I'm talking with Donna Carey, the director of a new documentary called Have a Good Trip, Adventures in Psychedelics. It features Sting, Sarah Silverman, Carrie Fisher, Anthony Bourdain, Ben Stiller, and many other creative people talking about their good, bad, and ugly experiences with drugs such as LSD, magic mushrooms, peyote, and MDMA. The film is hosted by Nick Offerman and includes commentary by UCLA's Charles Grob, who's one of the world's leading experts on efforts to use hallucinogens in therapeutic and medical settings. Carey won an Emmy for his work as a writer on Late Night with David Letterman, and since then has produced and written for shows such as The Simpsons, Silicon Valley, and Parks and Recreation. In a wide-ranging conversation with me, he talks about his own history with psychedelics and the need for serious, open, and well-informed conversations about substances that are routinely described as life-changing and are more popular now than at any time since the 1960s. Have a Good Trip is a fascinating look at the past, present, and future of mind-expanding drugs, and anyone interested in or worried by the neo-psychedelic movement can watch it now on Netflix. Here is the Reason interview with Donna Carey. Donna Carey, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thanks, Dick. It's great to be here. I'm thrilled to have this movie out into the world.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of a perfect movie for lockdown because if we can't travel outside, we can travel as far as our mind will take us or something like that.
Yes,
right?
yes.
So give me the elevator pitch of the documentary. Describe it for people who haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, so Have a Good Trip is 50-plus celebrity storytellers and some experts sharing their experiences on psychedelics. I thought it'd be really fun to bring some of these to life with animation. So it features a lot of reenactments and takes us to places you might, you know, have trouble visualizing. We're hopefully visualizing some of those. It also hopefully is adding to the conversation about destigmatizing this stuff. A lot of people have done it, some who might surprise you. And it's hard to do it in the elevator pitch. I don't have one, but we touch on a lot of things. And hopefully what we're doing is adding to the, bringing this a little bit more mainstream with the talk about how this can be used for many positive things.
Yeah. You know, and so you run the gamut from, you know, Deepak Chopra is in there, as well as Charles Grob, a researcher at UCLA, who is quite serious about using psychedelics and MDMA and other kinds of pharmacological substances, potent substances in psychotherapy and whatnot. Discuss a little bit before we get into the kind of, you know, some of the better stories or the more memorable stories. What is your hope in releasing this? You mentioned you want to destigmatize this, you want to normalize it, or, you know, what's your hope in having people you know, kind of engage with this topic?
Yeah, I think so. This thing started as my background is I'm a comedy writer and producer. Right. I worked on shows like Parks and Recreation and Simpsons and stuff. So as a storyteller, I was looking for comedy. What are funny stories? Where can we find those? This started about 11 years ago. And at the time, there were no one was talking about taking drugs. You know, that was only for edgy, way on the edge. And it felt like a good, uncomfortable, funny space to get people to open up about their experiences that would just lead to funny stories and bring them to life with animation. So that was the gist of it. As I got into it, I realized like, oh, these stories, Carrie Fisher says it in the documentary, psychedelics don't lead to orderly stories. So I was getting frustrated as I started interviewing people. I was like, give me a beginning, middle, and end, and then I can animate it. And these were like, well, and then I floated off into space. And you're like, well, that's not an ending. That's just nonsense. Yeah. And I realized like, oh, we're getting a lot more actually than just stories. We're getting a lot of, some of these are life-changing, some of these are transcendent, some of these are spiritual awakenings, and some of these are cautionary tales of people going like, these were not, my brain is not right for this. And I thought like, oh, what an interesting way to talk, have a rational conversation about what these drugs really do. And then I started reflecting on how I grew up and how I was informed about these, which was in the 80s and 90s in a time of just say no. And these drugs were lumped in with crack cocaine and
a heroin
and a war on drugs and addiction, and you shouldn't even talk about it. And I was like, that was not my experience growing up. So we made an after school special in this to kind of highlight that fear, that atmosphere that these had often been talked about, and go like, let's actually have a real conversation. This is what really happens.
The kind of framework which works, I think, extremely well is Nick Offerman is kind of a lab coat wearing, authority who is leading an after school special sort of framework in talking about this. I mean, what would we have done if nobody had created after school specials? Right. Well, how would we parody bad authority?
Right. Exactly. Thank you. Thank you, ABC, for those wonderful cautionary tales of.
And then you also have the More You Know kind of a parody on that, which is also helpful. Briefly, why don't you talk before we get to the celebrities themselves and some of the stories that are in there? You talk about you started this 11 years ago. The conversation was very different. What has happened over the past decade to make psychedelics, if not normal? I mean, they are being talked about, more openly and more freely and kind of more positively than probably ever since the early 60s, before they started getting demonized as LSD became popular among the counterculture. What do you think is driving the interest in psychedelics? And then also, what is kind of conditioning the positive regard for them that we're hearing about now?
I think one thing that's driving is we've gotten more and more divided. We've gotten more and more in a global state of crisis. People are afraid, things are bad. We don't talk to each other. We're killing the planet. Like these things that are existential. And there's sort of this moment of like, geez, maybe there's some tools that can help us figure some of that stuff out. Psychedelics certainly. So, it's always hard to verbalize these things because you often are dealing in cliches. And when you use psychedelics, it's often more of a feeling or an understanding than something you can say or illustrate. Yeah. But, they tend to push you towards a connection with other humans, with the planet, with, a sense of that we're all part of a thing together. And right. I think we're in a time where we're all questioning that, like, how come we're so divided? We're made of the same stuff. So I think that's been a natural thing. The other thing that's been happening is people like Charles Grobe, who's in the movie, he got FDA approval in the 90s. He's a hero in this space of somebody who sat down and went, let's do clinical trials. Let's do it with approval. Right. Let's do it in a safe way. Let's not just rely on people's adventures at dead shows to base our research on. And there's wonderful experiences at dead shows. But it started to be presented in a way that was coming from a laboratory again, where we have this weird disconnect where psychedelics, which have always been illegal and on the street, could actually treat opioids, which were done with pharmaceutical and blessing and et cetera, is that there's this sort of disconnect where things are a little bit backwards. So as more and more trials and more tests have been approved, I think the research is starting to really be a powerful argument that there's something here that we've been ignoring for 30, 40, 50 years.
Yeah, and it's fascinating. Obviously, in books like Michael Pollan's How to Change Your Mind from a couple of years ago, and I mean, that's capping off a lot of other stuff, but there's an interest in the first decade or two of actual psychological and medical research using LSD and other substances to treat things like alcoholism and criminal behavior. It's kind of exciting to recover that. And I think also one of the things that I think comes across in the movie, and I like the way that you were talking about it, we feel divided. I've taken psychedelics quite, in a lot of different contexts. I don't think they reveal the truth, but one of the feelings that you get when you take them is that sense of connectedness that you don't really get when you don't get when you're drinking, and I don't even think you get when you're smoking pot or something like that. But that does seem to be something that people report, that sense of unity or a sense of common common existence.
Yeah, I was one place we were exploring it and didn't make the movie, but you were talking about all the different phases of a trip, and at one point we were maybe going to structure this as a trip, you take it, you get butterflies, you suddenly everything's really funny, then you start to see stuff, then there's some bad things. That movie started to be 12 hours long and we were like, we can't make a 12-hour movie, that's too long. But
that's part of the problem with psychedelics, right? It's like golf, you need a lot of free time in order to take them on any kind of regular basis,
right? But then when you flip that and go like, oh, 6 months of therapy can be done in an afternoon. Right. You're suddenly like, oh, it's a short, if it's done right and in a controlled setting and with the right people and help, you can, it's an incredible speedboat to some big revelations. But I was going to say with the connection, one thing I was trying to describe it was, you know, we were talking about the mushroom laugh and you take mushrooms and then you just get like these belly laughs that are so deep and you're laughing. You don't even really know what it is. And it's like, you've been let in on some universal timeless joke that cavemen knew that we now all know. And you're like, I get it. And you're all laughing. And then you try to tell that joke the next day. And people are like, well, that's nothing. But there's this sense of profound connection with the history of mankind, with the history of the planet, with organic matter that we're made of is the same that makes trees. All that stuff is cool.
Yeah, it is. And you know, I like, you know, the movie is, I mean, on a certain level, you're proselytizing, certainly for the normalizing of these substances or the non-demonization of them. But a number of the people talk about how you really have to take these things in the right circumstances. You should always have somebody around who's not tripping. You can have a bad trip or a traumatic experience as much as a kind of aspirational one. Talk, who are some of your favorite people that appear in this, and what do you like about the stories that they tell?
Yeah, so I think that we started, I think Deepak might have been our very first interview, and he did tell some very funny stories, which we ended up saving, you know, because he spoke very eloquently about spiritualism and stuff. And I was like, oh, well, this is definitely an element of this. You know, Ben's story was certainly a touchstone, and Ben Stiller's story is a real cautionary tale. He took acid once, was not for his brain. I was like, oh, that's a really interesting edge to this, which is because a lot of the stories are like, yeah, I did it some. And when I was screwing around with comedians and stuff, those are sort of the fun middle stuff.
Right.
I think the first one that really I was like, oh, I think we might be really onto something bigger was sitting down with Sting. And I was going into that with a little like, of course, like, you know, I was a big fan of the Police and some of Sting's jazz stuff. And then I felt like maybe he was getting a little new agey or something. So I hadn't been following him in a while, but I was like, oh yeah, let's talk to Sting. And I sat down with Sting and had such a wonderful conversation. I mean, this was somebody who's done just on his own incredibly hard work, learning the psychedelic space, figuring out how it relates to him, how he can use it as a tool. He was talking about things that I hadn't thought about. He uses it to keep his ego in check, how to be a better human, how to relate to his family, how to make better music. And I started to go like, oh, well, this is much bigger than just funny stories. And Sting had some funny stories, but that was a one favorite interview because it was so interesting. Yeah.
It's impressive too. I mean, Sting and like you, you know, I'm a huge Police fan, and then I go in and out of his solo stuff, but he is a searcher and a seeker first and foremost. And you know, the guy is productive. He has what's he been going for like 40 years or something like that. And it's kind of powerful to think about somebody who's that creative is also regularly and in a very informed way using psychedelics.
Yeah. And a great, it sounds like, I don't know his kids or anything, but like seems like a great dad and husband. Yeah. And we went and saw his Broadway show recently, and I was like, he's making good stuff. This guy's great. Yeah. He sang, anyway, Sting was one of the big ones. You know, we also got some really interesting, like Steve Diggle from the Buzzcocks or the members of the band X, and some of the Chris France and Tina Weymouth from Tom Tom Club. I had these interviews that came in that I was like, I'm going to go talk to idols, you know, like these people who have changed my life with their music. And a lot of those didn't even make it into the movie ultimately, but are wonderful, you know, in their own right. And we'll find a place for those at some point.
You mentioned Ben Stiller before and his kind of rough trip with things. I mean, this is kind of amazing too, because so Ben Stiller is tripping and he calls his father, who at this point is best known as Frank Costanza from Seinfeld. What is it like to be tripping balls and then try to talk to Frank Costanza?
Unbelievable. I mean, and for Ben, it was like, you know, what was sweet about that was he didn't know what to do. The whole concept of reality was caving in for him. And he was like, I need to call my parents. They happened to be on an episode of The Love Boat together. So he had to call the set of The Love Boat, get through to his dad. And his parents were you know, pre-hippie. They were yeah. of another generation. And he described it. He's like, my dad didn't know what it, he's like, you drank battery acid? What's going on? But in a weird way, it was really grounding, I think, for Ben, because yeah. he loves his parents and they were able to talk him down, you know, and having that human connection and a grip to reality, you know, was great for him.
You know, there's other, I hesitate to call them cautionary tales because it's more an accident of the project taking a long time to unfold and then to be done. But Two of the most memorable voices in the movie, I think, for me anyway, are Carrie Fisher and Anthony Bourdain, who are both gone. And you know, Carrie Fisher died of, a heart attack or something related to that. But illegal drugs were or various kinds of drugs were in her system. She had a very public and struggle with alcoholism and drug abuse. And yet she said something really profound about how she felt when she did psychedelics. Could you talk a little bit about that? And then what it's like to work with somebody, you know, who later ends up dying, you know, much too soon, partly because of drugs.
Yeah, she's somebody I've loved forever, you know, from the Blues Brothers to Star Wars, is just an icon and a rebel and a wonderful, whatever.
And not just a great actress, but she wrote a couple of really good novels, and her show and book Magical Drinking, I believe yes. it was called, is phenomenal.
Yes. And I grew up, my mom battled alcoholism for her life. She was in AA for 40 plus years. So I always related to where Carrie was coming, that she's incredibly honest about that stuff and talked about it. She battled being bipolar and had a number of issues that she was working on. She's very clear in the movie, I think, you know, and I really let her, you know, like I don't want to put words in her mouth for sure, is she's really clear about that psychedelics were a different thing for her. They were not the problem. Heroin, opiates, like these things are addictive. They were bad for her. It was the thing that she felt brought her down and chased her whole life. Psychedelics for her were a place that things opened up and felt normal. And she was able to examine the world in a real way. And, you know, it was such a thrill to go to her house. She was like, take a look around. My house is the acid house. And we walked around her house. She gave us 2 to 4 hours of her time.
Yeah, it's a really fantastic sequence to be walking through her house.
And she you know, that interview goes on. And, you know, I was like, we should do a 2-hour share of this, because she was like, she says right up front, you can't tell an orderly story. And then she proceeded not to tell an orderly story for 3 hours. And I try to edit it together into something orderly. But there's a wonderful version of her just kind of like sharing these sort of images and moments from her career and all these people she worked with and shared experiences with, for, you know, across the world of comedy and music and stuff. She was also a seeker, like Anthony Bourdain and like Sting. It's like, this is somebody looking for truth, looking to find something that makes sense, you know, like truth, wherever it exists. So she had incredible adventures and access and realizations and stuff. So wonderful time we got to spend with her.
Bourdain is another person who it's kind of shocking to see him in the documentary, because you're like, oh, of course he's still there, because right. you know, we can watch reruns, and he is such a magnetic and charismatic character on screen, and the way he talks. And it becomes so much more poignant, realizing now it's been a couple of years at least since he committed suicide. His story is kind of a classic, you know, trip that is less, you know, it's less the Beatles and Peter Max, and it's more like, it morphs into a Goya painting or something.
Yeah.
What did he describe, and what was it like talking about him? And he, of course, very publicly, a recovering heroin junkie. So what he talks about, you know, it carries a lot of weight.
Yeah. I mean, he also really says, like, these are different drugs. Heroin's my downfall. You know, it was not good for me. I was a junkie. He talks about psychedelics. He was like, he had wonderful trips. He talks about doing hundreds of hits of acid over his lifetime and having these incredible moments, having it reveal certain things to him about travel and the planet and wanting to explore. You know, I think where I was really excited, because for me, some of that in my, as a kid reading Hunter Thompson, I was like, oh yeah, I want to get in a, Cadillac and ride across the desert and discover lizards and like something that was like a fire that was like, oh, that makes sense. Yeah, you should do that. Mm-hmm. I think he was very driven by the writing of Hunter Thompson. I think his whole career was a little bit of like Gonzo mm-hmm. travel. He was a big right. part of what fueled him, and psychedelics were a little part of that, you know, and seeing he eloquently says, which I love, is, you know, it helped him see the world from a slightly different, in a slightly different way, that this idea that we all have to empathize and learn different points of view, that was his life's work, was going out and meeting people and sharing their stories with his shows. And it started with food, but it was about politics and music and life experience and the human, how different people process the human race and going like, how can we learn from each other? Yeah.
There's a sense, and I think a couple of the people or a few of the people mentioned this, that LSD, or not LSD, but psychedelics more broadly, including things like MDMA and ketamine and whatnot, are kind of amplifiers. You've kind of brought up, or through the context of the movie, the idea of set and setting of, you know, having expectations for what you're doing and then doing it in a place that makes sense. How important is that to, you know, in a weird way, psychedelics are about dissolving all kinds of borders and boundaries and sense of self in the world and all of that. But there is a way that they can either be done kind of smartly or stupidly. What are the parameters that you put around a kind of positive use of psychedelics?
Yeah, I think at one point I was looking at all this footage and what we were putting together and kind of thinking like, oh, have we put together a 21st century user's guide? Is that what we've done? And then I was like, I don't want to tell people that they should do. I don't want to say we're a user's guide because that suggests we're telling people they should do it. I don't think anyone should do anything. I think people should research, get the information, and make informed decisions for themselves. I'll give you one example. I think is the right version of this for me. I'm not a religious person, but I do believe in being a moral person and spirituality and stuff. I think there's a lot of religions out there. If you're going to pick one, they're powerful tools. Be careful. Do the research. You know, if it's good for you, God bless you. Go with your gut. Those are individual choices. So a part of making this was stepping back and going like, let's give as much information as possible. You know, things like set and setting, having a guide, knowing this is a drug that your brain is going to be a little different on this drug. It's going to be time limited. You know, we found people who said all of these things. And I was like, oh, this is a wonderful way to do it. People are sharing their experiences and their practical advice. What can go wrong? What can go bad? Hopefully in funny ways. I've always found that movies that aren't preaching to me or over explaining that are just, that I'm on a ride. I you know, I worked on The Simpsons for years. It was the first place that I kind of was like, oh, we'll do an episode about gun control or about the Catholic Church or whatever, but it's in a cartoon and it's a funny family and you don't even really realize you're learning all these lessons or thinking about these bigger ideas as you're doing it. And I kind of went with a little bit of that, was like, let's stick with entertainment. And then some of this stuff gets seeded in with practical advice and from real people. And then hopefully smart people are watching and taking what they need from it.
What we live in a world now where, as you mentioned, some of the work that Charles Grobe is doing is FDA sanctioned. Organizations like MAPS, the nonprofit created by Rick Doblin 30 years ago, I guess, something like the 30 or 40 years ago. Yep. In the late 80s and 86, are in stage 3 trials using MDA to assist psychotherapy for PTSD and other things. Some cities have decriminalized magic mushrooms and things like that. Where do you see the psychedelic revolution going this time? And you know, what do you think has to happen for it to continue to proceed apace? Not to force everybody to take psychedelics, but kind of, as you're saying, you know, make it more available for people who want to. Where do you see that heading over the next, you know, couple of years? And what role do you hope to play in that?
Yeah, I would say, you know, to the extent that we're, you know, I would advocate for anything. It's like, I absolutely do not advocate for everyone to take psychedelics. That's a bad path. I think I would advocate for rational conversation. People like Charles Grobe, who have actual science, like it's weirdly the answer for a lot of our problems, is like, let's actually look at the science and listen to that and see where that takes us, and then figure out the best way for us to use that and integrate it into our society. It's very much, you know, I think the hope for this movie would be that it would help destigmatize a lot of people have experimented with psychedelics and not jumped out windows. Let's learn from what they've learned. Let's read the books again. Let's sit down. When we go back and look at what Cary Grant was doing with LSD in the 50s and the therapy he was using and how it helped him figure out who he was, is that these are powerful tools that we have at our disposal. It's crazy not to figure out ways to let them help us be better at what we're the human endeavor. You know, I think where I would love to see it going is more and more rational conversation, more and more ways to figure out how to do this in a safe space. You know, these are powerful tools. You know, let's listen to what Charles Grobe is saying. He's saying he wants to have therapy centers in nature where there's trained professionals with licenses, kind of monitoring, helping, you know, figuring out what your brain, if you're someone who's inclined to this, figuring out what your brain needs from it. What are good dosages? What are safe ways to get you there? You know, like, this can lead to scary stuff. Sometimes scary stuff is good, but it doesn't mean you have to be wandering around the street actually in danger. You know, you can be doing it with great music in nature and have scary moments, but come out of that and learn from that. And, you know, so I would say, let's listen to our science community and these researchers like Anthony Bosses and Charles Grob, you know, and what they're learning and what they're sharing with us. And then, you know, experiment in safe ways.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it there. I've been talking with Donick Cary. He is the director of the new documentary, Have a Good Trip, Adventures in Psychedelics. It starts streaming on Netflix on May 11th. Donick, thanks so much for making the movie and for talking to Reason.
Thank you so much for having me, Nick. Great chatting. Enjoy the movie, everybody.
This has been the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to this podcast and Reason's other podcasts by going to reason.com/podcasts or to Apple, Google, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Spotify, wherever you get your shows. Thanks for listening.